We have with us live in the studios this morning for Community Forum, Molly McLean and Carla Curio, who are both with the Palestine Solidarity Committee, and we're going to be discussing their recent trip to Palestine, Israel. Thank you both for coming in this morning.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Thank you.
Let me start out and ask you, when did you first become interested in the issues in Palestine, Israel?
I have grown up in a Christian home and just kind of was always in tune with the historical aspect of Israel, and did a Jewish studies minor in college and took Hebrew and always wanted to go to Israel. And then I started thinking about how much sense did it make, because we never talked about it in college, we never talked about the current situation. I started thinking about how much sense does it make for people to kill themselves, to kill other people, and just started thinking more and more about it and looking into it and investigating, and learned how much of an impact America has over there, learned how bad the situation is over there, and just kind of felt compelled to do something about it.
Yes. Well, I'm Greek Orthodox, and I've known the situation also over the years, and have known Palestinian families who also happen to be Christian and often go to the Greek Orthodox Church here when they do go to church. And I was always aware of the other side as I heard their stories of being refugees in 1948, being expelled from what was to become Israel. And it was hard for me to be active before, being a single mother with my son and running my business and all this kind of stuff, raising my son. And once he grew up and moved out and have now independent lives, I could become more politically active and put myself in situations that I wouldn't have put myself in before with a dependent child. And so I wanted to go there and see for myself what was happening with the Palestinians.
Okay. And then how did you specifically get involved with going over then? How did you cross paths with a local group?
We're both involved with the Palestinian Solidarity Committee, and through that we've known many people who've gone over to work with the International Solidarity Movement, which is a Palestinian-run organization that invites internationals to come. They organize actions and have their own nonviolent resistance to the occupation. And then a lot of times when Palestinians go to do nonviolent resistance, they often get treated as if they're being violent. They often get shot at by soldiers, and they're always in danger whenever they try to do anything. So the ISM, the International Solidarity Movement, will invite internationals to come and take a stand with them. And it tends to deflect some of the violence on the part of the Israeli soldiers towards the Palestinians while they're doing their actions. It often lends them a bit of safety. So hearing experiences of other people who'd gone over and worked with the ISM, we heard about it and went ourselves.
I guess for me, I've grown up thinking that having the impact of one person is very small, and that what I do probably isn't going to matter a whole lot. And even going to rallies, I had a hard time when I first started getting active, just even thinking about what is that going to do. It's not going to do anything. It doesn't matter. And hearing the stories from people who had gone, and just I guess hearing about the impact that they really did have and the real physical benefit that they brought, it just really encouraged me. And knowing what I did and feeling compelled to do something and feeling like it could make a difference, that was enough to make me want to go.
The most incredible difference to me was the impact I felt I had on the Palestinian people that I met and stayed with. Everybody's conversation is about how can the world be looking on what is happening and not care about us? They all have conversations with me around feelings of being abandoned by the world, and that they feel nobody cares or is aware of their side of the situation. And me being there, I also felt, as an American, I've traveled throughout Latin America for years, And people who are politically active would feel a lot of animosity towards me as soon as they found out I was American. And I'd have to really hang in there for them to see me as a human, because they'd always associate me with my government, and my government with a lot of the brutality that the kind of problems that have gone on in Latin America. And in Palestine, I never felt anybody have anything against me because I was American. I'd say, you know, you're so nice to me. And these bullets, I mean, my tax dollars pay for these bullets. How can you be so nice? And they'd say, "This, you're here to stand with us. It's your government who's doing..." They're very clear about making that distinction between myself as a human standing with them as humans, as opposed to my government that is behind supporting the Israeli military occupation of the people. And so it was the humanity of the people and their perseverance and their love towards one another and their openness and generosity to me that really affected me. And I realized that was my true impact, was being encouraging to them just with my presence, them knowing that there are people who know we're not as abandoned as we think we are.
So where did you end up working when you were over there?
Both of us ended up in the Gaza Strip. There's a town that's right on the border, the southern border of the Gaza Strip and Egypt. And the Israeli army is building a wall there, a big metal wall. And in fact, the Gaza Strip has been fenced in since 1991, making any kind of travel or working in Israel almost impossible for most people. And then with the current intifada that started in 2000, it pretty much is impossible to leave the Gaza Strip. But so they're building this new wall that is just supposedly more secure. And along with that wall and that security, there's a wide swath of land that's in Rafah that they would like to have be empty, that previously was full of homes that were full of families. And so the International Solidarity Movement wanted a group of people to be there for the first time, actually. They'd had some issues with people being in Gaza, so this was kind of the pioneering trip. But the goal was to basically stay with families whose homes were targeted for demolition, not for any terror reasons, but because they happened to be in the way of this wall. And so we both ended up in Rafah in the Gaza Strip. And, yeah.
And what did you see when you were there?
Oh, my. There's this wall. It borders this whole edge of Rafah and parts where the wall is yet to go. It borders the whole edge of Rafah with Egypt. And all day long and all night, there are tanks. And they go back and forth, and they go back and forth.
And they shoot.
Then they'll just stop somewhere, and they'll randomly start to strife a whole neighborhood with gunfire. So you could be walking down a street that opens out on this swath of land where the tanks are going back and forth, and one will stop. You might not see it, and then it'll just start shooting. And if you're on that street, you know, people suddenly start ducking into doorways, and you hug the walls as you're walking down. And people wait for the gunfire to stop, and then they continue on their ways. Mm-hmm. I maybe had a couple nights where there was no gunfire. Pretty much all night long, they do this, and it's to terrorize the population. It's to terrorize the population. I never heard gunfire going from Palestinians back to these tanks, because first of all, what a waste of ammunition for the Palestinians. They're not going to have, if they have guns, they're not going to have enough bullets to waste at a tank, because these are tanks that are shooting.
So it sounds like you wouldn't even get any sleep in a situation like that.
I guess what I saw was a bunch of people living totally normal lives and getting married and going to school and studying for their tests. And one of the boys that I was staying with cried one night because he was really worried about this test he had the next day. And, you know, just very totally normal lives. Yet at the same time, on top of that is this whole different layer where, you know, right next door to this kid's house where he's studying and crying because he's going to fail his test, there is a tank sitting there. And, you know, they wake up every morning and say, you know, Sabah khair, good morning, Dababa, good morning, tank. And, you know, potentially get shot at if they see you looking out the window and the tanks run up and down all night long and all day long, just shooting randomly. And you do have to sleep. You know, you do have to go to school. You do have to do all those normal things because there's really no other option. And I know I heard many people talking about how if they didn't hear tank fire at night, you know, the joke in Rafah was, if you don't hear it, it's like music to help you sleep by. And if you don't hear it, you can't sleep because, you know, what's going on? Like, I need my tank to help me go to sleep. And so I guess it's really hard for me to talk about it because the amount of fear that you have to live with to be in that kind of situation and the amount of strength that you have to live a normal daily life is so, I can't explain it well enough to, I guess, do the people their honor. So I have a hard time talking about it.
Well, they've normalized it. This is normal life for them. This is listening to the tanks at night. I mean, I stayed with a teacher in her home one evening, and she was telling me that it's impossible to teach her children. She goes, and she's giving lessons, and kids are falling apart, like falling asleep at their desks mm-hmm. because they didn't get the amount of sleep they needed the night before. I mean, if there is gunfire right out your home, you lay there in bed and you wait for it to stop, but you don't sleep. You rest, you know, finally around 5 in the morning when the gunfire stops, then you go to sleep. But not every neighborhood is getting assaulted every night. They pick and choose neighborhoods. So if one neighborhood's getting assaulted, the neighborhood that was assaulted the night before is sleeping because the gunfire is not right out their door. And if the gunfire is far enough away, it's quiet enough where you can sleep through it. She also told me there were times where during her school classes they would actually be fired on in the classroom and the kids would have to, you know, fall out of their desks onto the floor to try to avoid being hit. I mean, this is normal life.
I have to assume people are getting hit when this is happening, that some people are getting injured.
The other thing I think was one of the most amazing things to me was that more people didn't die when I was there because of the randomness. The home that I was staying in when I was there with the family did get shot into. Just huge explosions ripped through in the middle of the day. You know, I was reading and Firyal, the mom, was cooking in the kitchen, and we heard the gunfire getting closer and we all knew to get down. And then, you know, shots came through the wall, and it has to happen all the time because it's random tank fire. And when I was there, a 10-year-old boy and a 13-year-old girl, two different times, were shot in their homes.
A 9-year-old was shot while I was there right after you left. Yeah,
but just in their homes, in their beds, like just sleeping or hanging out, because so people do definitely get shot a lot.
All right, and were there also actions involving house demolition that you saw?
So in Rafah now, I guess between probably about 600 homes have been demolished, which means almost 6,000 people have been rendered homeless. And the home that I stayed in was demolished when I was there. And what that meant was, it's not like, you know, someone comes and knocks on the door and says, hello, we're putting a notice on your home and it's going to be demolished tomorrow, so have all your stuff out. In fact, what happened was, again, Furiyah was cooking, the kids were studying, and it was like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and all of a sudden they just heard this giant explosion and they had no idea what was going on. They went, you know, screaming, crying hysterically down 4 flights of stairs. And what had happened was a bulldozer just came and rammed into one of their walls, totally knocked down the wall. But they had no idea what was going on. They had no time to get anything. They had no time to do anything. They just had time to get out. Thank God they had enough time to get out. And then that night, it was just kind of, I had a friend who was there, actually, and he said it was basically just like hell. Like, there were grenades that were thrown into, there was 3 homes that were all the same families. And without warning, without anything. And there were people in the homes. They just threw grenades into the house. It was either grenades or tank shells. They couldn't tell which. Then the army turned off all the electricity for the entire city and sent troops in. And at that time, my friend and the guys who lived there all left. But they sent troops in. The troops set dynamite. And then as my friend and the other guys were running away, the house totally exploded. Like, 2 blocks away, concrete was just flying everywhere. And then an Apache helicopter came. 12 tanks came. So that's kind of just, and then that same night, 12 homes in that area were demolished, and that kind of stuff. I mean, I think about when I was there, an average was probably one house every 2 days, but then sometimes there end up being like 15 done in one night.
And is this in a clear pattern? I mean, because you were talking about this wall being put in. Is this in a predictable pattern, or is this, again, kind of like the firing from the tanks, kind of a random type situation?
All along the border of Rafah, the edge of Rafah, where this wall is going up, they're saying they want 70 meters. And how many feet are meters? 70 meters, which I think is a couple hundred feet. On the Palestinian side of the wall, they want cleared as like a security zone. So there's a pattern in that this is the area they want clear. However, they are going way over the 200 meters, and they're destroying everything, fields. They want it all flat, homes, anything that's in the way. So what they'll do is they will terrorize a neighborhood with gunfire, hoping that the families right there on the edge will abandon their homes and that they can go in and destroy these homes once the families abandon them. However, these people are very persevering. It is the Palestinian strategy is to not leave. I spoke to many people, and that is their commitment, is we will not leave. And so they will stay in their homes until their lives are in absolutely, irrevocably in danger, like what happened with Molly and this family. They will stay there.
I guess what I think in terms of pattern is that, yeah, there's that, you know, that's certain space between that and the wall, but like what you're saying, like there is no pattern, and it seems like it's on purpose. Mm-hmm. There is no pattern so that people can learn what to expect tomorrow. There's no pattern to learn what to expect when your home is going to be demolished. Mm-hmm. How safe do you think you should be? There is no rule about it. People previously had been notified, you know, by loudspeaker, your home is now going to be demolished, get out. Or people aren't. Or Apaches come. Or the bulldozer comes. And so it seems like there's a very clear strategy of not having a clear strategy that makes it much more terrifying, I think.
Right.
And in fact, the family that I stayed with, the night the home got shot into, the dad, Mustafa, ended up crying, which I think is, like, not okay, because his wife was pretty mad at him for crying. But he just said, you know, what can I do? What can I do for my family? What am I doing? My family is here, and I can't protect them, and I can't even get them out, because he was actually, they were too poor to leave. They couldn't afford to leave. He said, if I had enough money, I would be in the middle of Rafah. There's no way I'd be here if I had enough money to get out. I don't want my family to get shot at. So
that would... The Israelis, do they offer compensation for when they're going
in?
No.
No. They're offered nothing. They don't even get tents.
Actually,
that's by the UN.
The UN does give some people tents to live in. And the Israeli army will actually come and bulldoze over those as well. Mm. And I'm not sure why, because they don't put the tents in like places that are in the way of the wall. They just, I don't know. Compensation, no. In fact, when I was there, no one had ever seen a human Israeli before.
That was the thing. There was a day where I was with a group of internationals, and we had gone to look at the wall, and a tank approached us and started shooting over our heads to warn us, and then started shooting at our feet. And there were a few Palestinians with us who then backed off and went behind and hid behind the walls. But this tank approached us, the internationals, and the Israeli soldier that was in the tank actually lifted up the hatch and came out and was talking with us. And in the end, when we turned around and walked back and joined the Palestinians when this encounter was over, one young man who spoke English, who was our guide for the day, came up to me and said, Carla, I had never seen an Israeli face. That's the first time I have seen an Israeli face. Gaza is very different from the West Bank. In the West Bank, Israeli soldiers and Palestinians confront each other all the time. They're at roadblocks. They're in the streets in jeeps, in APCs. They go into homes. They're visible to the population on a daily basis everywhere. In Gaza, they're around the perimeter. They have very tall towers that are sniper towers. Well, maybe they call them watchtowers. But from these towers, people can get shot anywhere in Rafah. And so they're never seen by the Palestinians. But they're there. They're a constant presence.
Well, Speaking of presence, that seems to be one of the main reasons that you both went over, was to have an international presence there to ideally minimize the impact on the Palestinians. Did you see where your presence had, I mean, you just gave a perfect example where your presence did have an effect, but for instance, in the bulldozing of the houses, it doesn't seem like your being in them really slowed things down any.
Right. That is one thing that we were trying to deal with. I think the goal of the internationals being placed there, especially in Gaza, because the soldiers didn't know us, you know, just like the Palestinians in Rafah didn't know about the ISM, the soldiers don't know about the ISM. We were hoping that with international presence, it would be a deterrent, and that didn't work so well. But I think what ended up happening is when we were first there, we didn't know what to expect. And the feeling, the impression that we got was that they didn't care that we were internationals. They would, you know, shoot into our homes anyway. They would, you know, someone actually almost got bulldozed one day, and they just didn't really care. So, but actually what ended up happening after I left is that the internationals became way more, I guess, I don't want to say
visible.
Aggressive, but
visible.
willing to get hurt. And so the internationals actually pitched tents on land, on homes that had been demolished already, kind of as, there's like a borderland. There's like this, the wall, there's dirt, there's like rubble from a demolished home, and then there's homes that still have not been demolished yet. And they pitched tents on the homes that had been demolished. And actually, some families that had lived in the homes that were the next in line moved back in because they felt safe because these tents were there with internationals there. And the police chief of Rafah came to the ISM and said, you know, thank you for being here because we think that fewer people have died this week because you guys are here being in the way like this. But, I mean, I think it's a cycle. I think it's not going to always work that way. I think that the army has ways of getting around that kind of stuff. But
what, in terms of looking at the big picture of what's going on there, I think some people need kind of a context to look at it, to judge it by. A lot of people will say, well, you know, this stuff has been going on for years, and who are we to jump in on that?
Mm-hmm. Well, for me, that was another reason to go, is that when we hear about the conflict that's happening, we do not hear about it in the context of occupation. We only hear about the terror that the Israelis, and it's a very real terror, what they experience, their fear of another Palestinian getting across into Israel and blowing themselves up in a public place. And that's a real terror. We don't, however, hear about the 3 billion?
Million.
Million. There's a lot. 3 million Palestinians that are besieged on a daily basis, and the kind of terror they live through on a daily basis. And that's why I went, to put a human face on this Palestinian population whose terror is not known by the world as precisely and vividly as the Israeli terror.
I think for me, the context, what really helped me to understand the situation, and I guess I would also preface this by saying I don't feel like I have what I would call the right to interfere. I don't feel like I know enough. I don't feel like I'm an expert at all. But I do feel like learning about the history of Israel and learning about how it was created, that it wasn't empty, that there were people that lived there that got kicked out, that got killed, that got, you know, villages were razed. You know, there's like 300 villages that were lost.
418.
Oh, why?
In Israel.
Yeah. In, you know, before the creation of Israel. And just also the other kind of contextual thing is what international law says about all this stuff. It's there. Israel is breaking so many international laws and is in violation of so many, I think the last count it was like 72 UN resolutions. And
on a daily basis.
Yeah. Geneva, the Fourth Geneva Convention is completely not. In fact, just a couple days ago, we heard a story about a soldier saying, you know, the Fourth Geneva Convention can go to hell. Yeah. And that's just kind of, I mean, so contextually, the history of Israel is very unknown here, that there were people there, and they were Palestinians, and they were kicked out and made refugees. And that also every day, the Israeli government and the Israeli army are breaking international law.
As well as the weapons that are being used over there, those have a connection here as well.
Oh, we pay for them.
Yeah, speaking of having an impact, speaking of being interfering, you know, what right do we have to interfere?
Yeah, we're paying for those bullets.
that we're paying, whizzing by over your head.
We're paying for those tanks. We send Caterpillar builds the bulldozers, the armored bulldozers that are responsible for this destruction are Caterpillar bulldozers.
And Boeing Apache helicopters shoot missiles into homes and
GE, the motors that go into the Apache helicopters.
In fact, America gives Israel, out of all of the one-third of all the aid that America gives out to the world, one-third of that
goes to Israel. It's our only democracy in that part of the world. Of course, for me, this occupation does not look like my idea of democracy. And if you were to look at Israeli politics within the country, that to me no longer looks, that doesn't look like democracy either. So I don't understand our reasoning, but that is often what we tell people. And because Americans are basically uninformed, they don't know better but then to believe that indeed we're over there because we have to defend Israel, who is our the only democracy in the region.
My understanding is the Palestinians within Israel don't all get to vote. That some of them do, but it's...
I'm not sure about the voting, but I do know that there is a lot... I don't know about that, but the discrimination... There is discrimination that happens that's... just kind of inherent in the laws.
They don't have the same civil rights. They don't have the same civil rights. And I don't understand how the voting thing goes. I know that there are many Palestinians who are considered Israeli Arabs. They don't call them Palestinians there, who are Israeli citizens. But then I was in East Jerusalem staying with an Arab family, and they were not given Israeli citizenship. They could not vote, although they were taxed, just as the Palestinians in the occupied territories are taxed. Mm-hmm. So we talk about taxation without representation. I think there was a war fought about that, like, you know, a couple hundred years ago. That
here in this country.
Here, right, in this country. And so there's not the same civil rights, although they have the same, you know, taxes over their heads and...
All right, well, we only have a few minutes left. I understand you are going to be speaking tomorrow evening. Is that correct? And going into much more detail than you've had a chance to this morning. Can you tell us where and when that's going to be happening?
It's going to be at the Ethnic Cultural Center Theater, and that is on the corner of 40th and Brooklyn in the University District. And it's going to be at 6 o'clock on Sunday.
And it's also going to be tied to the situation with Iraq.
Very good. And also, is there contact info if people want to find out more about local organization here? And
there's one website that has just been put up. It's www.eyewitnesspalestine.org. And then there's another one that I forget.
Oh,
that's the only one I remember. But on that, there is contact information.
There's plenty of contact info on that one website.
Yeah.
Phone numbers. Connections to other websites, emails, things like that.
Yeah.
Very good. All right. Well, we still have a couple minutes left. What message would you like to leave listeners with about the situation in Palestine, Israel? Would you encourage other people to look into the ISM?
I would definitely encourage people to look into the ISM. And to educate themselves. Educate yourselves. Don't just listen to the way our media represents situations throughout the world. Palestine and Israel, it's only one place, but it magnifies the situation that is really universal here. And I think it's our responsibility as an educated people to educate ourselves and to not take it for granted that we're just getting the truth by whoever opens their mouth. Don't believe me. Don't believe Molly. You know, do your own research. Go online. Talk to people.
I think I would just emphasize that point. I really agree with that. I mean, it happens so often that you read the news, even on the web, and you know, it just doesn't make sense. I read an article the other day about Palestine, and it was talking about how this 62 marketplace was just raised in the West Bank. And the article didn't make any mention of the fact. I mean, it said, well, Israel said that the buildings were built illegally, and the Palestinians said this was yet another way that the Israelis were waging a war on their economy, and back and forth and back and forth. It's, you know, it gives the impression of the never-ending cycle. But it didn't mention the fact that they're building a wall, and that's why they did it. And that, you know,
they say these buildings are in the way.
But they didn't say that in the news.
Right.
So if you were, as a reader, you know, as an American citizen reading these things, what I would assume you would feel is, why should I care about this when it doesn't make any sense? I don't know who to believe. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just this back and forth that I can do nothing about. You know, and so I would encourage people that if you're reading something or if you're hearing about something that doesn't make sense to you, there's probably a reason for it. And instead of just backing off and assuming that you just don't understand or you're not smart enough or that, you know, it doesn't really matter, assume that it does matter. And there's a good reason that you're not understanding it, and it's because the information is missing, and find out what that is. So,
all right. Well, those are good words to end on. Out of time. Talking with Molly McLean and Carla Curio, who are both with the Palestine Solidarity Committee, and thank you both for coming in this morning.
Thank you, Mike. You.